Hey campers, KJ here. I think about Gretchen Rubin's four tendencies rubric frequently. My personal label, which I sometimes resist because, of course I do, is rebel. It's hard for me to do anything expected or demanded, and the best way to get me to do anything, even things I want to do, is for me to believe that other people think I can't do it. The more impossible, the more rigor I bring to the task. Understanding that about myself has helped me in more ways than I could list here. We dug into so much in the interview I'm about to share with you, but in particular, we were chasing after anything and everything that would help us and you sit down and get the work done. I promise it delivers, which is why I've brought it out to share again. If you heard it the first time, you might get even more out of it now that some time has passed. And if you didn't, stick with us for something good. But first, are you ready to finally finish that book draft or revision? Are you itching to learn new tools or frameworks to make the writing process easier? Are you looking for a side gig to add to your repertoire? Author Accelerator's Book Coach Certification Program is a robust and exciting way to learn new writing and publishing skills. Their certification course in fiction or nonfiction includes hundreds of hours of video lessons, workshops, and practice exercises, all about researching the marketplace, querying agents, project management for your book idea, and more. They're great, and I say that as someone who's done this. Many writers come to the program looking to up their writing game. Writer and certified book coach Trevor Brooks says, "This course changed my life. I feel more confident than ever in my ability to develop a manuscript as both a writer and a coach that will attract the attention of an agent and a publisher." So, if you're ready to try something new and join a community of writers and book coaches helping writers, visit authoraccelerator.com/writing to learn more. Oh, one more thing. If you're not signed up to get our emails, you should be. Last week, email subscribers got links to 3 pop-up write-alongs with me, KJ, and there are more coming, along with thoughts on revision, TikTok, and more. Pop your name on the list at amwritingpodcast.com. Am Writing peeps, if you've listened to me for any time at all, you know I love Laura Vanderkamp. She's given me some of the best lessons about using my time, like the reminder that I'm rarely too busy, I've just made different choices, and one of my favorite phrases, people are a good use of time. Laura reminds me that if you want to have done something, you have to plan to do something. Because I always benefit from a reread of Laura's books, we're bringing you this earlier interview and sharing it again. But Laura also has a new book out, Tranquility by Tuesday, 9 Ways to Calm the Chaos and Make Time for What Matters. The idea, if you upgrade your Tuesday, that'd be the run-of-the-mill day, you upgrade your life. The 9 rules here really do offer big impact from small change. I can't recommend it highly enough, and I hope you enjoy the interview. I know I enjoyed doing it.
Is it recording?
Now it's recording.
Yay!
Go ahead.
This is the part where I stare blankly at the microphone and try to remember what I'm supposed to be doing.
All right, let's start over.
Awkward pause, and
I'm going to wrestle some papers.
Okay.
Now 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
Hey, I'm KJ Dell'Antonia.
And I'm Jess Leahy.
And this is Hashtag Am Writing.
With Jess and KJ.
Hashtag Am Writing is our podcast, which I'm guessing you already knew. But this is the podcast about all things writing. Short things, long things, essays, books, proposals, pitches. And most of all, Hashtag Am Writing is the podcast about sitting down and getting the work done.
I'm Jess Leahy. I'm the author of The Gift of Failure and the forthcoming in a long time, 2020, I think, The Addiction Inoculation, about preventing childhood addiction. And you can find my work at The New York Times and The Atlantic and Washington Post and Vermont Public Radio and all kinds of fun places like that.
And I am KJ Dell'Antonia. I am the author of the basically pretty much already here, depending... We're right about the moment when you can actually buy the book,
How to Be a Happier exciting.
How to Be a Happier Parent. I am also the former editor and lead writer for the New York Times' Motherload blog, still a contributor there, and, you know, a writer. That's what I am.
just writing stuff, getting it out there, and that's what we do here.
And in the name of sitting down and getting the work done, we are thrilled to have a guest with us today. We have Laura Vanderkam, most recently the author of Off the Clock, Feel Less Busy While Getting More Done. And if that doesn't sound good, I don't know what does. But she is also the author of a whole bunch of other books that have really changed the way I think about time. One of them is 168 hours, and the other is I Know How She Does It.
That's the one that really made me think about my schedule and say, wait a second, I have no time, but look, she interviewed like 1,000 people who say they have no time, and look at all the time they have.
She is the reason that I no longer ever, ever say, I don't have time to do that. Mm-hmm. Instead, I say, not always directly to the person who's asking, I don't choose to do that. Because realistically, this was years ago, I was just, her books are the reason that I realized if I have time to like drive 2 hours to pick up a kitten, which at the time I totally did, I probably have time to do your volunteer work.
Yeah, probably.
Just not going to. So, welcome, Laura. We're so happy to have you.
Thank you for having me. I love that introduction. That was great.
It was long.
Oh, no, that's true. We have all the time in the world, right?
Yeah.
When you tell people what you write, what do you say about yourself?
Well, I say I write books on time management and productivity, though I write other things too. You know how it is, though. Once you write one book on a topic, that tends to be what you're known for. And it's been a good topic. I find you can get through all sorts of things through the lens of time.
I was going to call you an efficiency expert. Does that kind of cover things too?
Sure. I like that. People have written some. I had one very oddly translated article about me that called me a time management sorceress, which I thought I should probably put that on my business card.
So that would like be very that. Good on the business card, or possibly a t-shirt.
T-shirt, yes, exactly. I'll wear that around.
That would be really excellent. So this is kind of intimidating because, you know, constantly we sit here and we talk about, oh, it's so hard, it's summer, or oh, it's so hard, the children, or oh, it's so hard, the haying, or whatever the thing is.
Haying, wow.
I know, KJ.
Yeah, I'm weird.
Yeah, KJ's got some stuff on her schedule that kind of is dictated by the world outside the office, which can be, you know, kind of challenging. Like the hay is ready, it must be put in, other horses won't get fed. But so how do you... We always like to ask sort of what does your writing schedule look like? How does your daily process go as a writer?
Well, so in general, I try to have my mornings for writing. We're recording this in the morning, so clearly that is not always the case, although I did write mostly from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. today. I find that I'm really at my best in the morning hours, that I have the most focus and discipline to get stuff written. I can go back at different points and edit or deal with the emails and calls and all that. That is also part of the business of being a writer. Most of my writing occurs, I have a home office, occurs between the hours of, you know, 8 or 9 and 4. It tends to be when my children are out of the house, which is key for having it be nice and quiet and enabling concentration. But I travel a fair amount for speaking as well. And so on those days, I do a lot of writing on planes, writing in hotel rooms. You can write anywhere. In fact, I've recently realized that writing is really a great way to pass a long plane flight. I try to plan my writing for those plane flights so I can get in that nice sense of flow. And it's not just about it being uninterrupted time, like, isn't this great? It's also that I really don't like flying all that much. And so if I get in that flow, then it's like, oh, look, 90 minutes have gone. Great, because that's 90 minutes I really didn't want to be on a plane anyway.
Well, I have to ask you a totally self-serving question, one that's come up a lot on this podcast. But as someone who also does a lot of traveling and speaking, and I have to say, last year I saw more of Laura Vanderkam than I think I've ever seen in my life. And it was because we did the same series of conferences. And so it was like, ooh, yay, another instance I get to see Laura. But I have a lot of trouble writing on the road. I can do it on planes. That's not my problem. There's something about being away from my research and my books and my stuff and my desk. I don't know. I have a lot of trouble in hotels. Do you have a way of getting around that, or do you just sort of give in to the ennui as I do?
Well, I think you have to know yourself. And if you know that you're going to give in to the ennui, you may as well embrace it and use that hotel time as time to, say, get caught up on emails or planning stuff, doing maybe shorter writing things instead of the deep work. And that's fine. You know, maybe that's just the way it is. But if you are trying to get some sort of intense work done, you know, I think it helps to plan out exactly what it is, plan out when you're going to do it, because once you're there traveling, you're probably not going to want to decide to do it. Traveling tends to take a lot of energy, and so that takes that energy out away from the decision-making process. So know ahead of time what it is you plan to get done during that time that you're, say, in a hotel or backstage at a conference or whatever it is. Try to keep your expectations relatively limited. This is probably not the time you're going to edit the entire novel. So keep that in mind. And then reward yourself in some way. Maybe it's getting out of the hotel room for a little bit to walk around, go get yourself a cup of coffee at Starbucks, and then come back to the room instead of just making it there in the hotel room with whatever they have on hand. That can help with the process.
I actually planned for it this time. My deadline for my next manuscript is at the end of a summer, which is when I generally get the most of my work done because it's summer and I'm not traveling. So anyway, but thank you for that. That's really, really helpful. I'm always trying to come at new approaches for how to handle that. So
I think one of the big messages of your books, and I heard it in what you just said now, is that if you decide what you want to do with your time, you will... You'll increase your odds of actually doing it. And once you've done, you feel like you have more control over your time. And I think that's been huge for me and works for a lot of people. That wasn't a question.
The decision-making process, it beats, you know, it consumes a lot of energy. And so one of the things I always try to do, well, I plan my weeks ahead of time to know roughly what are my big professional and personal goals I want to accomplish in the week. But that tends to be a little bit more nebulous of when everything is going to happen. I have a rough idea, but it's not, you know, down to the hour. But then the night before, you know, one of the things I do to plan for each next day is look at my schedule, say, okay, well, what calls or meetings or travel is on the schedule? What else am I planning to do? When are those things going to happen? And because I know when those things are going to happen, I am more likely to actually do them. There's this funny thing. If you assign yourself something the day before, when you're looking at it, it's like, oh, somebody else assigned it to me. It's yourself. You can not do it. You can blow it off, whatever. But I think having something on the calendar for a certain time just gives you that good student nudge to make it happen.
Well, and leaving the space for it, like taking a realistic look. This is another thing that you talk about in your books, taking a realistic look at how long it takes you to do something and then leaving that time. I have to go to the grocery store today. That's going to take me 2.5 hours because the grocery store is a long way from us. And, you know, it's very easy to be like, oh gosh, I gotta go to the grocery store. I just gotta grab a couple things. It's gonna take a half an hour. It's not. So it's important to be...
We call that, the blue sky version, right?
Oh God, I'm definitely suffer from the illusion that I can get places instantly. Mm-hmm. I have to be there at 11. I'll just leave, right before.
11.
2 till. Yeah. And 11. That'll work.
That'll work. It doesn't. You'll be late. If you want to be late, that's fine. But if you don't, then you got to build in the amount of time it takes to get there. Build in your transition times. I sympathize with that. I really don't like going to Costco. My husband does, but I always have to convince him. Like, you, by the time you from when you leave the garage to get there, you do your shopping because it's huge. You know, you're putting the stuff back in the cupboards at home because it's not in bags either. You know, you're just loading everything out of it. It is a 2.5 hour process.
It is.
And you need to know that going in. So if we have something at noon and you're leaving at 10:30, it's not happening. Like, that's not a Costco chunk of time. If you want to leave at 9:30, then sure, that's a Costco chunk of time. You can leave at 10 and then not put the groceries away. That's also an option. But, you know, we should know what this chunk of time is.
Well, we definitely want to talk about Off the Clock, since that's your most recent book. But the question we get most often, and actually one that came up in when we were interviewing David Sedaris, we were talking about his schedule and he was talking about writing and how writing goes for him. And he said, basically, I don't know how people with children do it. I mean, all these people coming in and messing with your time. And he has this very wonderful husband, boyfriend, Hugh, who doesn't mess with his time. And he made the joke that people with children, he just doesn't even know.
He said, he said, can you imagine? And we were both like,
yes,
we can. Thanks.
I think the question we get most from, especially in the Facebook group, in the Am Writing Facebook group, is about What do you do? How do you prevent your life from your schedule, your writing schedule, from going to heck? I mean, how do you, especially during the summer? In fact, someone messaged me yesterday with the very simple question, is it just me or is it harder to get stuff done during the summer? And, you know, I think that there that question comes up a lot, mainly because children are in the house. But do you have like secret, what do you do when people say, you know, how do I manage my life when the rest of life is trying to intrude?
What is the secret?
Yeah, what's the secret, Laura? You're the one who knows all the answers.
Good childcare.
That is definitely secret.
I'm serious because I think a lot of these people have this idea that writing is this thing you can do while also caring for your kids. And that's not, I mean, you don't have to have maybe 40 hours of coverage if your life is writing. But like if you are writing professionally, it is your job. And that requires treating it as your job. Yes, there's flexibility. Yes, you may not need the 40 hours, whatever. Yes, you'll probably be home more than somebody who has to commute somewhere from 9 to 5 every day. But it is still a job. And the idea that you can write the great American novel with like 4 children underfoot and, you know, it's going to be hard to pull off. So I have all, you know, through my years of raising my 4 kids, they're still pretty young. They're 11, 8, 6, and 3 right now. I've always had full-time childcare. And then I can write during the workday instead of trying to squeeze in a little bit here during nap time or after the kids go to bed or early morning or something like that.
Now, you have interviewed a lot of people who have what I would call a side hustle. So for a lot of our listeners, writing, while they want to do it professionally, it isn't their profession. So they're in the bind of a day job plus, you know, wanting to get the writing done. And I know you've talked to a lot of people who have sort of a similar thing, even if the thing they're trying to get done on the side isn't writing. Can you talk a little about how people, you know, fit that extra thing in there?
Yeah, I mean, well, the first thing to know is there probably is time. So there's 168 hours in a week. So if you work 40 hours and sleep 8 hours a night, so that's 56 hours per week, you've still got 72 other hours to play with. So, you know, devoting 10 hours to your side hustle or to your writing is not a huge ask, right? Like you can probably find the time, particularly if you're good about not taking a whole lot of other things on that could easily consume those hours that you do wish to devote to your side hustle, to your writing projects. I think, you know, one thing you can do is track your time and see where the time is that's kind of not sort of high demand, a lot of things happening to you at the same time. So probably you're not going to come home from work, you know, you have your kids clamoring for dinner and say, okay, now's the time I'm going to devote to my side hustle. That's probably setting yourself up for failure because you're going to be tired. You're going to want to deal with other people's demands at that point. So for many people, it does wind up being like you get up first thing in the morning and do the writing. That tends to be a time that's quieter around the house. You probably have more energy, particularly if you have a good cup of coffee. So a lot of people also think that getting up early is going to make them sleep deprived, but it doesn't have to. You should just go to bed a little bit earlier. If you track your time and see how you're spending the time before bed, a lot of people aren't spending it on things that are, you know, terribly high value to them. It tends to be, you know, surfing the web, hitting next in the next Netflix queue, or, you know, puttering around the house, inefficient housework, that sort of thing. So if that's you, you might want to cut that off a little bit earlier, go to bed a little bit earlier, wake up a little bit earlier. I do tend to think that going to bed early is how grown-ups sleep in. So if you can get your head around it, that it's some sort of indulgent thing as opposed to like, you know, bedtime battles from childhood that you're revisiting, you'll probably feel better about it. So yeah, get up early and do a little bit in the morning. You know, there might be like some weekend time. If you are, you know, co-parenting with someone, you might trade off some time on the weekend that you say, okay, I'm going to write on Saturday mornings, for instance, or maybe it's going to be Saturday afternoons. I'll go to a coffee shop and work for a bit while my partner has the kids or while kids are at their activities or something like that. But look at your schedule and say, well, where could I find those 10 hours, whatever your goal is, and track yourself and see if you are, in fact, devoting the time to it. But the other thing is you really have to expect that other people will respect it. I think a lot of times we tend to view our passion projects or side hustles as maybe not as important as everyone else's demands. And, you know, if you don't want to do it, you've got to stick up for it. You can't just give it away when somebody asks you to. You have to you know, do your best to protect it.
Well, and if you want other people to respect it, you have to respect it. And I kind of I want to go back to this idea of getting up early, which you're right, it means going to bed earlier. So one of the things, I've got my book, How to Be a Happier Parent. And if you pre-order it, this is in the nature of a little promo, but not really, because this is very much on point. If you pre-order it, one of the bonuses is a one-pager on having happier mornings. And one of the keys to having happier mornings is to go to sleep earlier. And something that I've realized in interviewing parents and teenagers is that the reason we don't want to go to bed is that we don't feel like we get any free time. Like all of our time up until 9:30 or 10:30 at night is owned. It's school, it's homework, it's activities, it's sports, it's cooking for other people, it's going back and doing our email, it's driving people places. So it's not until, like, you're not off the clock until 9:30, and then you're like, I want to go to bed because this is the first time all day I've been, you know, free to be myself. So to me, one key to respecting that morning time is to let some things go for that evening time, so that you can, you know, get that feeling of being released and getting ready for rest before you're like sort of urgently throwing yourself into the bed.
I totally agree with you, because I think one of the, yeah, people stay up late because they want the me time.
Right.
And the me time doesn't start until everything is done. But like the truth is nothing's ever going to be done. I mean, this stuff like housework, like the house is always going to wind up messy again. So if you're cleaning up every night, like, you know, it's just again the next morning, whereas you won't get that time back. One thing I would also say is I keep reading articles, you know, about like how to have better mornings that talk about, oh, get everything ready the night before. The problem with that is that pushes back your bedtime,
right?
Because you can't have your me time till after you've packed all the lunches and packed all the bags and put everything and chosen all the outfits and everything. And then, you know, that stretches out the time after the kids go to bed before you can have your me time. So you don't start your me time till later. You want your me time. You go to bed later. Then you wake up in the morning and you're all fragged. And then you have a bad morning because you got ready the night before. It's this bad thing, like, that, you know, people are giving bad advice there. Don't get ready the night before. That just spreads your getting ready over the night and morning too. And it makes you have a crappy morning because you've gone to bed too late. So, you know, let a lot of that stuff go. Go to bed earlier. After you've had your me time, just start your me time earlier.
Sometimes you have to reframe, right? This is another big thing about
sleep is me time.
Yeah, sleep is me time. No, but this is another big thing that you talk about, which is just looking differently at how you're spending your time. I mean, what I talk to my kids about is like, look, I get it. You want me time, but you chose to play this sport, and you may need to, on some nights, you may need to consider that. That's your free time, because that's how you chose to spend it. And so you need to sort of, as you're doing it, feel like, you know, this is me getting to do the thing that I chose to do. So if everything is a choice, if everything that you're doing, you know, I mean, obviously not everything. You have to feed your kids and brush your teeth. But, you know, if by and large, you're framing the things that you're doing as a choice in your, you know, non-work time, then I think that also is a way to make it feel better.
There's this other thing that Tim and I, my husband and I, do that it always surprises us how much we enjoy it. When we were both graduate students and working too much, the only together time we really had was when we worked in the same place at the same time. We would go to a cafe together and we'd both sit there and he would do his stuff for grad school and I'd do my stuff for grad school. And yes, it was super dorky, and no, it was not terribly romantic, but it actually kind of was, because that was at the beginning of our marriage. And, you know, and so now occasionally when Tim has a lot to do and I have work to do, once people are sort of doing their own thing in the evening, we sit down and have this, you know, big dork fest. We sit at the same place and work together. And if you say that's what you're going to do, is instead of it being the default, you know, oh, we're just going to work and we never get to spend any time together, and we reframe it as, you know, we actually really like working next to each other and having that time that's actually put out there for that, as opposed to being like this boring default thing that we kind of do. I don't know, it's a little romantic kind of, and I'm getting my work done. So it's a throwback to when we first got married and when that was our only way to have any time together. So there are ways to reframe as well and make things your own.
I totally agree. And it might also be that you carve out one night during the week where you just go, straight to some other place to write after your workday. So you don't be involved in the evening for that particular day. And that can open up a lot of time too. So maybe just go to the library from, you know, 6 p.m. till 9 p.m. when it closes and sit right there. And that, you know, people have this sort of thought like I have to see the kids every night, which is not true. Like you're there six nights a week, not being there one out of seven is not a huge trade-off necessarily, if it opens up quite a bit of time for you to then do this other project that you have, and instead of trying to do it at night, where again it cuts into your sleep time and things like that. So
I actually think that's really, really good for kids. I talk about this a lot when I'm on the road talking with parents, that it's really great for our kids to see us modeling for them how we set time apart for things that are really, really important to us. And as long as it's, you know, when the kids say, oh, where's mommy? And your partner, spouse, whomever is saying, you know, look, mommy's off doing following her dreams, doing the thing that really means a lot to her, which is, you know, mommy's always wanted to be a writer and she's out there doing it. And we're going to be really proud of mommy for, you know, making goals and achieving her goals. That kind of modeling is just the kind of thing that our kids need to see when we, you know, when we talk about what it takes to achieve the things that are really important to us.
Yeah. And if you think 168 hours, not 24, then it's not this huge trade-off, right?
Like, absolutely.
I think that's the important thing to keep in mind, too. View time a little bit more holistically.
And it's kind of amazing what a large chunk of time an evening is when you don't have to feed people and put them to bed.
It really is.
Oh, yeah.
It really is.
I mean, maybe you could even leave work by 5, be at the library at 5:30, like 3.5 hours. Wow. That's quite a bit of time.
It really is.
Well, I actually tell people I had to finish law school when my oldest was an infant, and my mom would come out during exam time to take him on these marathon long walks. And she would leave the house and I'd say, okay, I have 2 hours and that's all I've got. Because not only do I have an infant when she comes back, I also have a guest I need to entertain. And so, mm-hmm. you know, it's amazing what happened in those 2 hours. And I say this not to boast, but because it was absolutely true. I got my best grades in my last semester of law school when I was juggling an infant because that's when I learned how to be efficient. I don't think I was terribly efficient before that.
That's definitely true. A lot of people find that. I think, you know, parenthood doesn't change people so much, but it reveals sort of who you are in many ways. And, you know, some people who were efficient before become a lot more efficient. Some people who had more of a problematic relationship with time find it very disorienting and they can't deal with it. And I always examine those stories of like, oh, it's impossible to work and have kids, that it's possible to do both and, you know, life will be crazy. And often what it is that people had sort of this more relaxed relationship with time, which sounds nice, but it's hard to make work when you are dealing with kids and a job and anything else you're doing on the side. So people be like, oh, I, you know, work best at the last minute. I get this rush of creativity, which is, you know, fine if you don't have kids messing with your schedule, as we talked about Dave Sedaris talking about. But the problem of leaving stuff to the last minute when you have kids is then one of the kids will get sick and you have to deal with that. And yeah. It's like, oh, wait, no one can have it all. It's like, well, yeah, you can, but you just had to start earlier and not leave it till the last minute. That's on you. That's not on the nature of parenthood itself.
There's a fantastic book called Dry by Augustine Burroughs. And when he stopped drinking and someone told him that he was really, truly going to have to go to a meeting a day for the first 90 days, whatever. And he said, well, how on earth can I go to a meeting an hour a day? And they said, well, you had time to drink all that drinking that you were doing, to do all that drinking that you were doing. And he realized, oh, yeah, that was like 8 hours at the end of each day. So, yeah, yep. maybe I have an hour. That. And for me, actually, that made a big difference, too. The playing fast and loose with time definitely it definitely improved when I stopped drinking. That was something that sort of messed with my efficiency as well. So that was something I had to cut out in order to make way. And I wrote a blog post about that called What Gives, about, you know, the fact that for me, in order to write the book, I did have to give that up because that was what really messed with my efficiency and my time.
That certainly can, you know, if you wanted to, for instance, write at night, but then you had had a drink or two, maybe that sometimes people are more creative like that. Sometimes
yep.
They're not.
Yep.
So you have to know yourself in that regard.
One of the things we love to do in this podcast is talk about what other people read. KJ and I actually haven't really talked much because she's been on vacation and we had recorded some podcasts ahead of time. So we're catching up on what each other has been reading as well. So do you want to start, Laura, with what you've been reading?
Sure. Well, a couple years ago, this is one of those things I thought I didn't have a whole lot of time to read. And I know, like I say, it's not a priority, right? I know the language I would use myself. And so I was just saying, like, reading wasn't a real priority at this time of my life. And I tracked my time for a year and I realized that I had read something like 350 hours that first year, which is almost an hour a day. It's quite a lot. But the problem is it was not really much good stuff. It was all, you know, magazines and stuff. And there's some good stuff in magazines, but also I was reading a lot of the same how-to article over and over again. And so I realized, Air Pop popcorn is a great low-calorie snack. Yeah. I read that again.
Yeah.
So I decided to start, you know, I do have time to read books. Like, I will use these 350 hours for reading more literature. Just have to be more serious about choosing the book. And realizing that, like, I could actually read long books in that time. So anyway, over the past 2 years or so, I've been reading a lot more long books. In this past month, I started the month reading Middlemarch, which was on my list of big books to tackle.
Can I just tell you, I just grabbed my notebook. I am showing KJ that that's on my list.
It's true.
Seriously. It's on your list.
It's
on a lot of people's lists. It never comes off the list.
No. Like, so, it's on my list of what I'm reading now. Because I went to my in-law's house, and it's my father-in-law's favorite book. And one of my very favorite writers is Rebecca Mead at The New Yorker, and she has a book called My Life in Middlemarch. And so I had never read either one, and I'm like, now's the time. So I actually have both.
And good. Yeah.
I'm so excited. So how are you liking it?
Well, I finished it. It was slow to start. Like, I had read the first, I was reading it on my Kindle, so I think in percents. I had read the first 5% sort of on a plane somewhere. I just couldn't get into it. I was like, oh, this is, like, so belabored and so about the, you know, Jane Austen-ish of, like, the class differences between people and the whatever. I've had a hard time reading Jane Austen, too. Anyway, so I read the 5%, and then I was, like, on another flight, and I had, like, literally nothing to read. I had forgotten my book, and I had not had downloaded anything to my Kindle, so I'll go start again. And I got a little bit farther, and then once I was about 20% in, I actually really got into it, because then you start knowing the characters and knowing the plot and what's going on, and it gets a little bit more entertaining. I think it's good, and it's also good to read, like, women writers from times when there weren't as many women writers, and to sort of see what they were covering. And she's really funny, she's like making fun of these sort of pompous people, and like, oh, I have some sympathy for this thought that, you know, we see reflected in someone's eyes that maybe we are not truly completely adorable and we always thought we were. And there's these little asides, you know. So once you realize that that's what she's doing, like, that it's actually funny, then it's much more readable. And so I finished it while I was at the beach about a week ago, and quite liked it. So know that it's long.
It is very long.
What is it again?
Middlemarch.
Oh, just plain. You wrote My Life in Middlemarch.
I have two. I have Middlemarch, and then I have Rebecca Mead's My Life in Middlemarch, which is about Rebecca Mead's. It's Rebecca Mead's very favorite book. And so she wrote a book about her relationship with her, like, seeing her own. She was talking about the fact that the fun thing about Middlemarch is that she feels that it grows with you, that as you read it at different stages during your life, you see different things in it, and that it has very much affected the way it's affected her in different ways at different points in her life. And so she decided to write about that.
That was why I was confused. I was like, are we talking about actual Middlemarch, or are we talking about the other one? And why would someone write a book about Middlemarch but not in our time? Anyway, it's all because while I was trying to tell you what I'm reading, I forgot the title, which one does. So I've got this new discovery, which is that you can find books on Google by Googling, like, the six things you remember about the book. So I just Googled new paperback, none give up child Irish. And sure enough, It was a little bit of a ways down, but I found the book that I had been reading, Saints for All Occasions, by J. Courtney Sullivan, which is just out in paperback.
And you're enjoying it?
I finished it. Okay. And yeah, I did enjoy it. It's a little bit... Sometimes I'm just like, do all the novels have to be about unwanted pregnancies? Or, I don't know. Sometimes it just feels a little bit like... Yeah. So to that extent, but the way this was dealt with was definitely different and really deep into characters that were obviously very unlike the author, which is, I don't know, it's intriguing. It's a good read and it's new in paperback.
I got a really funny recommendation from Wendy Ahrens, who's been on our show before about humor writing. She recommended a book called Less by Andrew Sean Greer, and it's hysterical. It's very, very funny. And it's been a great run for me because I read, right before I read Less, I read Straight Man by Richard Russo in the wake of our Richard Russo interview. And Straight Man is one of my, it's just so ridiculously funny. And so it's been really nice to be on a humor novel jag. And Less by Andrew Sean Greer was so great. My husband actually has been listening to it as well and on a long car drive, actually down to your neck of the woods. And was texting me when he was charging up his car about various parts that he loved. He was quoting it back to me. So it's a really, really great read. Less by Andrew Sean Greer. Loved it.
I'm going to look for that.
Yeah, it's very funny.
It's been so long since I have read a book that I was like, oh, I didn't want that to end.
Yeah. This one's good. Let me think about it. I'm not, it's funny.
Well, and we don't necessarily agree on, that's the hard thing. It's like somebody else can feel that way and you're like, no, God, I wanted it to end so much. I just closed it.
But you think
made it end.
You and Wendy have a similar humor sensibility. Yes. So you'll probably like it. Like it. So
anything else, Laura?
Is there anything else
your recommendations?
Well, actually, I just I found this great blog post from over at Modern Mrs. Darcy of like 20 novels you can read in a day, which is just like a gem for adding to your to be read list, because there's something very after I made my way through Middlemarch, it's like I needed some short books that I felt I could read in a plane flight or read even in an evening while I'm relaxing or something like that. And so I made my way through a couple. I finally read The House on Mango Street, Sandra Cisneros'
book. Love that one.
I read Uncommon Reader, the one that's about, you know, Queen Elizabeth becoming this voracious reader. I read The Sense of an Ending, which was a very strange book. I haven't quite sorted that one out yet, but I just finished it.
As a short read, I can highly recommend The Very Thin 84 Charing Cross Road, one of my very favorites, and it's a very quick read, and I absolutely love, love, love that book. And then I actually read a couple of novellas, because the novella is such a weird format. I read the novella that the movie Shawshank Redemption was based on, by Stephen King, and it's just beautifully written, and that's one of my favorite movies. But novellas are a great way to fit in a great read when you don't have a lot of time.
Yeah, which is actually, and if I can do a quick promo here, going to be my next book.
Please tell us. I was afraid to ask. No, I was going to.
It's a time management novella, which I hope doesn't sound horrible to people, but it's in the genre of business fables, which people have read stuff like Five Dysfunctions of a Team or the Go-Giver series. It's a bit like that. And it's called Juliet's School of Possibilities, a little story about the power of priorities. And it will be out in March of 2019.
Oh, that sounds really fun. And
I can't
different
wait.
And unusual. Yeah.
Oh, that'll be really, really cool. We will definitely be reading it, that's for sure. And we want to, we always like to give you the opportunity at the end. So if you want to know about either Off the Clock, her most recent book, Feel Less Busy While Getting More Done, or I Know How She Does It, which is one of my favorites, where can we find you? And where are your links? And where are your handles and all that good stuff?
My handles, yes. Well, you can come to my website, lauravanderkam.com. I blog usually four times a week there, so a lot of new content. if people are looking for other podcasts beyond this one to listen to, there's only so much Jess and KJ that will fill the time, one commute a week, and then you need more. You can listen to Best of Both Worlds, which is my podcast on mostly about how professional women who love their careers, love their families as well, with Sarah Hart Unger. The two of us have been doing that for about a year. Or find me on various social media, usually at L Vanderkam. That's me on Instagram and Twitter and various such things.
If someone wanted to see you in person, do you have a schedule on your website for where your travels will take you?
I don't really, because a lot of stuff, it's been a lot of corporate, you know, and so other people can't come to that per se. But I will be sure to put up any, you know, if you want to watch my TED Talk video, that's always a way to
please do. What is your TED Talk called, Miss Laura Vanderkam?
It's How to Gain Control of Your Free Time.
Excellent.
And it only takes 12 minutes to watch. So if you are looking for a 12-minute little breather while at work, watch a little video while you're having your coffee. That's something you can do.
Yay. This has been such a pleasure, mainly because we adore you in general. We're just in awe of your productivity and your ability to, not only do you blog, you engage your audience in a way, you have a really wonderful and enthusiastic and loyal following, and you're all over the place. So we're really just in awe of how you do it.
And I would say that if you enjoy AM writing, you will probably enjoy Laura's podcast as well. It's a pretty similar just exploration of sitting down and getting the work done. It's just not the same.
Exactly.
All right.
Well, thank you. That was really sweet.
We'll let you get back to your most productive time of the day, because goodness knows we don't want to rob that from you. So
this was a great use of time.
Thank you so much.
Oh, wait.
What?
Wait, I have to say.
What?
Laura, there was a line in Off the Clock that, as I look at the title to make sure, that has just... I like to have a mantra, like something that I say to myself when things are just when I need one. And so you had a line in there that has really been amazing for me. And it was, people are a good use of time. So sometimes, you know, when you thought you were going to have 2 hours of writing and instead, you know, a friend needs you or a kid needs you or maybe you just end up, you know, spending more time on the phone with a parent or whatever. I just, if I even have a twinge of, oh, that's not, you know, I needed that time to do something else, I just say to myself, people are a good use of time. And it has really, or even like when I'm making a decision, like, you know, do I want to spend time with a friend or do I want to work more? People are a good use of time. So I wanted to thank you for that. And also for saying that we're a good use of time, because that's...
Yes, you are. I'm glad we can, you know, it was fun to see Jess at all those conferences in the past year. That certainly makes going to the conference more fun. I'm looking forward to seeing you, KJ, at an upcoming podcast conference. So it's really good to get to know people over time. You keep seeing them, and that's one of the things that makes this business a lot more fun.
It really
Absolutely.
Does.
All right, everyone who has been listening, thank you so much for... I feel like if you've been listening, you've sort of snuck in on one of our sort of little... It's like a friend conversation. It's always so much fun to have these. Until next week, keep your butt in the chair and your head in the game. This episode of Hashtag #AmWriting with Jess and KJ was produced by Andrew Perella. Our music, aptly titled Unemployed Monday, was written and performed by Max Cohen. Andrew and Max were paid for their services because everyone, even creatives, should be paid for their work.
Thank you.
Hey, listeners. If you're not following along with Jess on Instagram and TikTok, you should be, because she's killing it with advice on kids and addiction, and because she's learning things about Reels and TikTok that could apply to you, too, and she'll be sharing more soon, so you're going to want to know what's been going on. Look for her on Instagram as @teacherleahy and on TikTok as @JessLeahy.